Rewind, your week in review is sponsored by the Transportation Development Association of Wisconsin, sharing one goal, enhancing the quality of life in Wisconsin through the development and maintenance of a strong transportation network. The Transportation Development Association of Wisconsin, it's how we get there.
Because I don't want to go backwards. I want to keep going forward. Together, that's exactly where we're going to go. God bless.
I'm Steve Walders.
And I'm J.R. Ross.
This is the first Rewind of 2018, so we're going to talk about happenings in the Capitol this week, and we're going to look at the 2018 political calendar in Wisconsin. But first, Wis I Was There, Charlie Sykes talks about how he went from conservative talk show to working for New York Times, NPR, and MSNBC, and a St. Francis police officer says our canine police dogs should have the ability to receive Narcan in the event of opioid and other emergencies. Wis I Was There.
I appreciate the introduction, but I also want to put it in some context for many of you Wisconsinites who are wondering, what the hell happened to Charlie Sykes? So my 2017 was rather extraordinary. Rather than doing a conservative talk show host, I now work for MSNBC, of all places. I work for National Public Radio. One of my op-ed pieces for the New York Times, just found out this morning, was one of the top 10 of the year for the New York Times. So there are people who will say, well, you sold out. You are the Benedict Arnold of the conservative movement. My argument would be, no, I haven't changed, but something happened to conservatives.
To give you an example, we grow a yellow corn, a blue corn, and also a white corn. And it's absolutely critical that these stay pure. It would be like if you were raising German shepherds and a black lab showed up one night, your puppy crop wouldn't look so good. And in fact, what you end up with is this, and the only value of this is hanging on the door at Thanksgiving. So the point I'm making is that this farm, because of the way that it's laid out, is practically irreplaceable, and it sure seems like they're going to just appraise it as a regular price. And so I feel that it's very, very, very important to compensate the people for the actual losses rather than just part of it. And Representative Brooks, I don't mean to rewrite your numbers or anything, but 100,000, my gosh, if this is the right thing to do, which it is, how can we decide that 100,000 is enough? If somebody's loss is $1 million, why does that person have to donate so much more to the road or the power line or whatever it is that goes through?
I know that our communities have a lot to offer young families. However, Wisconsin's small villages and towns are not exempt from the trends of the last 50 years. The American population has been shifting away from rural areas towards cities and suburbs. And many rural counties in Wisconsin are losing or barely holding their population base. We need to find a way to maintain and grow our population. And to that end, that's why we are proposing Assembly Bill 730.
I guess I would just want to think more holistically about how do we get people to rural areas, and I think there's two basic things. One is, you know, invest in the local community, but two, do it in an equitable way. But student loan refinancing is an example of, that would apply to everyone. Everyone with student loan debt could get the opportunity to lower their costs and save money and pay their student loans off faster. And hey, there's a tax deduction on top of it. So that might be something else to consider if we're having a conversation about student loan debt and getting workers to Wisconsin, is how can we offer something that's equitable to everyone regardless of which county they live in.
I'm Officer Holly McManus. I'm with the St. Francis Police Department, a very urban community in the Milwaukee County area. This is Bane. He's a 6.5-year-old German Shepherd. Him and I have been partners for 4 years now. Right before the last legislative assembly, we had found, as Sergeant Noel brought up, he had alerted on a car, and inside we found methamphetamine. I was in a different jurisdiction, so about 15 miles out of my city. And after he ate the guy's cinnamon roll, he then found the drugs. And I was worried that that cinnamon roll had something in it, or that in the process of trying to hide the drugs from the police. So I had to monitor him. I was concerned of possible overdoses. I do carry Narcan as of very recently, but I didn't have it that day. I got it the next day. So it's just something for me to think about as a handler, as handlers in general, that sometimes we may be in a different jurisdiction and we want those EMS personnel to have the availability to treat our canines.
JR, the governor made big news yesterday. Lincoln Hills and Copper Lakes mm-hmm. have been under fire for, well, the Racine County judge wrote the letter 6 years ago.
Yeah.
They've been investigated for 3 years. The governor now late yesterday afternoon said, I'm going to recommend if I'm reelected in my next budget, and that's important, closing them and moving the juvenile inmates to 4 correctional facilities and 1 mental health facility, which would be new. 1 correctional facility will be in northern Wisconsin. I think he drew a line from La Crosse to Manitowoc.
Yep.
Juvenile institutions would, the juvenile prisons would be converted to a medium security prison. Remember, there's a study committee on do we need new prisons, so that would alleviate some of that. And it would price tag, according to the Journal Sentinel, $80 million.
Yeah, and GPR supported borrowing in the next budget.
Big deal?
Yeah. Now, to critics, Walker probably created this problem, right? They closed down the former youth facilities in
Ethan Allen.
Waukesha County for boys and Racine County for girls, moved everybody up to Lincoln Hills, and then created Copper Lake, the girls' facility. Studies suggest that if you isolate prisoners from family support structures, cause problems. Well, we have problems up at Lincoln Hills. Now they're looking at a regional approach, which I believe, like Missouri, is used some other places. These regional facilities around the state, expanding Mendota and Madison to treat more people with mental health issues. It's moving to that model. Now, to critics, Scott Walker is trying to get ahead of a couple of things. One, he's got a re-election in November. This is something that could be an issue for him. And two, former Corrections Secretary Ed Wall has got a book coming out in August that yeah. seems to be ready to, he's got an axe to grind, both against the governor and Brad Schimmel. So maybe this is getting out ahead of that. Of course, the flip side is, the governor's office says, look, we've worked this for a year, all right? This has been something that's going on for a long time. It's not a reaction. They also said after Democrats came out saying this is not quick enough, that they're willing to work with lawmakers to move up these dates if they want. Now, what I don't know is how fast can you build a prison? They're talking, I believe, 32 to 36 beds at these regional facilities. You got to find a site, you got to design it, build it. So how quickly can you do that? Could they really be open before 2019? I don't know that answer.
Well, let's look at some of the reaction, which you alluded to. Assembly Democratic Leader Hintz said, if the crisis at Lincoln Hills were a priority, we could act today. There's absolutely no reason to put this plan in the budget. The governor said by removing one from one facility to several facilities across the state, and placing a focus on mental health and trauma-informed care, we believe this plan will improve long-term outcomes for both juveniles and staff. Two more reactions. Senator Schilling said, it's essential that we find a workable solution that will bring about better outcomes for juveniles, offenders, their families, and our communities. And Speaker Voss endorsed it, but he didn't speak to the timetable. The timing of this announcement, I'm sorry, Speaker Voss endorsed it.
Mm-hmm.
So, but now, you and I just read a press release from Republican Representative Joel Clayfish, Democratic Representative David Bowen. They both said, we're open to moving on this in this session.
Mm-hmm.
Now, another thing we were going to talk about today, there's only a few days left in this session. What, 3, 5, 10?
I would guess that the Assembly will be on the floor a couple of days in January, a couple in February. That's it. I would guess the Senate will be in one day in January, one in February, one in March, likely. That's my guess, though that could change. Those are plans that Voss and Fitzgerald indicated to me when I talked to him for the end of last year. What will be interesting is Democrats have been saying, okay, great, you're doing this now, but we've been asking for this for a while. There have been a bill. I mean, go back to the joint finance process of the budget. Democrats emailed me a series of motions they put forward during the finance process to close Lincoln Hills and Copper Lakes, to do various things. They're saying, why didn't you take us up on the offer now? Walker had been saying for a long time, up till now really, he can make Lincoln Hills work. They can fix this. Now it's saying, no, it's not going to work. We're going to a different model. Why? You know, only he really knows. But I don't know for sure this has been a driving issue in the campaign this fall. Like Tony Evers, Dana Walks, Verona came out and slammed the plan.
But you know, you read what Dana Walks said in mm-hmm. response to Walker's announcement. It takes a federal criminal investigation to get our governor to act. That's Dana Walks talking, that's not me.
Yeah.
So it's going to be a central campaign issue.
But for the average person, is it a driving issue? Now, the Democrats have to make it an issue of a failure of leadership. That's how they use it, I think. That would be, it fit into an overall argument. But I don't know if the average person in La Crosse or Eau Claire is really worried about what's happening at a prison in Irma, right? So that's what I don't know for sure. How would it fit into the debate? And I've had a couple people say, look, not big, that big of a deal. But for Walker, this seems to address an issue and maybe take it off the table for the fall, or well, at least address it for the fall.
Front page of today's journal, Sentinel, showed a beaten-up staff worker at Lincoln Hills. So people can relate to that. I think it's got some legs as a campaign issue.
I just don't know how big. If you look at the big picture of, do you have a job? How do you feel about your tax bill? Is your kid's school doing okay? Have the direction of the state? Those are big things that drive voters to me, from what I've been taught by people who run campaigns. I'm just saying, I don't know where in the priority of like issues does this fit in. Is it a top four? But is it, can be used as an argument of the overall leadership of Walker? Yeah, probably. You know, that way, probably.
One thing they could do this session, they're only going to be in a few days this year. They could vote to close these two juvenile institutions and date it January 1 of 2020. Therefore, the funding would drop in when they pass the next state budget, which would be a symbolic vote to close it, date certain, and we'll pay for it later.
Now, after watching this last budget process, it got finished September 15th.
21, I think he signed it.
Yeah, passed out of the Senate the 15th, I think it was, or whatever, 17th. My question is, if they're late, can the money be spent? And these are things, could they find money? Possibly. But I'm trying to figure out, I don't know if they want to do that unless they have a commitment to spend the money ahead of time, because if you get the money September 1st, can you get it done and open by January 1? I don't know it's possible.
Okay. All right, new subject. I'm going to walk through some of the political calendar this year. Let's look first at the January 16th special elections. Mm-hmm. First in the 10th, Democratic Patty Schachner, Libertarian Brian Correa, I'm sorry if I mispronounced the name, and Republican Adam Jarko. Jarko, clear favorite?
It's been interesting this week in talking to folks because there is a flurry of advertising backing Jarko that we've seen. Americans for Prosperity, WMC, the Wisconsin Alliance for Reform. Jarko's up on TV with and radio with his own buy. And that's not including the Wisconsin Realtors political arm doing issue ads for him ahead of the primary. We're not seeing an equal response from Democratic groups right now. Now, I'm talking to folks, kind of ask why, because if this is really a truly a wave year for Democrats, that's a kind of seat Republicans could lose. They should hold on to it. On the numbers alone, they should hold on to it. But it's a January election. Who knows who's going to turn out? Who's more motivated? I get the impression that Republicans know if they were to lose this seat, it would send reverberations through the Capitol, that there's a wave coming and would give Jennifer Schilling momentum to raise money and say, look, we won this seat, Terry Moulton's seat, Frank Lissay's old seat. These are on the table now, the Republican-leaning seats, but they're on the table because of what we did in the 10th. They know the stakes there. For Democrats, it's a conundrum of if they go all in and come up short, it takes away another sales of saying there's a wave coming. So but if they don't play up there, they don't have the chance. So I think they're kind of, I get the impression they're trying to like work phone banks, do mail, and count on a motivated base rather than an air war that Republicans are trying to kind of launch up there and keep that seat.
Yeah, but remember residents of the 10th Senate, they're flooded with Vikings football games and Twin City media. It's really a tough market.
It is very expensive, which is why like Jarko's ad is not on broadcast, it's on cable. These ads are mostly radio and cable so far to target people. Digital ads are becoming a bigger part of campaigns than they ever have before. 4 years ago, I hated writing about digital ads because they seemed like they weren't really effective. They are now becoming a preferred method of communicating to voters because they're like, when I say digital, they're like the B-roll that you get on if you go to YouTube to watch like me playing guitar and learn a song. I will sit to that ad. That ad is going to reach a targeted audience. Your Facebook ads, they're going to reach a targeted audience. Whereas a broadcast, who's watching, you know, how many people are watching a 7 o'clock show on NBC anymore or CBS? It's a splintered audience. You can target people. So up there in the 10th, digital ads are a way to go to reach people.
Okay. And then in the 58th, that's been a traditional GOP seat. There, the special election January 16th to replace the term of the late Bob Gannon, the Republican Washington County Chairman Rick Gundrum versus Democrat Dennis Degenhart. GOP lock?
I don't hear any Democrats talking about that one. That would be, it would be, I would bar the door if I were Republicans if somehow a Democrat won that seat. It would be like the upset of the century.
Okay, and then the 66th, there's only one candidate, Greta Neubauer. So she's going to get the seat, the former Racine Mayor Corey Mason, who resigned.
Okay, he resigns actually the day before or after the general election, so. He still technically has the office.
Okay, let's spend just a little bit. January 24th, the governor gives his seventh State of the State. Is that going to be the official drop the flag on his reelect?
Oh, it helps set the stage. They always do. I mean, State of the States in budget years helps set the stage for your budget. in election years. It helps set the stage for what you talk about ahead of your re-election. So that's kind of a no-brainer for him.
Now let's look at the spring elections, the February 20 primary. We have three candidates for the Justice Gableman's seat on the state Supreme Court, Judge Michael Skronik of Sauk County, Tim Burns of Middleton, and Milwaukee County Judge Rebecca Dallet. By the way, a programming note, I'll be interviewing Tim Burns on Monday. I'll be interviewing Rebecca Dallet and Michael Skronik on January 22nd. The general election, April 3rd. What are you hearing? It's early. It's a little bit early, but what are you hearing?
There are two competing forces at play in this primary. One of them is that Wisconsin voters tend to like some of the judicial experience with the Supreme Court. We've seen that in race after race. The second one is if you have a liberal, a conservative, and a moderate, the moderate has a tough time finding traction. We saw that in 2016 with Joe Donald running in the middle, Joanne Kloppenberg on the left, and Justice Rebecca Braley on the right. Donald got about 10% of the vote, roughly. So what I'm watching is which force wins out. The left and right are better places to be, or the judicial experience is better to have. Burns is running a progressive campaign, unabashedly so, but he has no judicial experience. How will that play with the primary voters? And, you know, primary voters tend to be more partisan. I mean, they were talking like, what, 12, 18, 20% turnout? We're talking the base of the base.
Yes.
So
the base of the base, that's
yeah,
true.
You'd think that would help Burns, right? Yeah. But again, I haven't seen a big air campaign from anybody yet. Usually I have Supreme Court races that like a week before the primary, something will pop on the air, or like I said, talking digital ads, we'll see some kind of like quick flurry of spots to help. You know, electronic, I'm going to guess, is going to get conservative help. Will somebody help Burns or Dallet? We'll see a flurry of stuff. Primary ends, and then it's quiet until like 14, 21 days out from the April election. All of a sudden, it's another rush of stuff.
Avalanche of stuff.
Unless there's money for stand-bys, but yeah, usually.
Well, anybody can say they're going to run for anything until June 1, mm-hmm. which is the deadline to file nomination papers for governor and lieutenant governor, the U.S. Senate seat of Tammy Baldwin, U.S. House seats, all eight, they're two-year terms, 17 state Senate seats, the odd numbers are up this year, and all 99 assembly seats. So June 1 is when we really see who's serious, correct?
Yeah, so it's been a few weeks, so yeah, forgive me my total, but I think I counted like 17 Democrats in mid-December who are officially had registered to run for governor. Now, I think Kurt Kober now had registered, but now he's actually going to run for lieutenant governor, and Keller Royce was on that list yet, and Paul Soglin is apparently on the verge of getting in. So
who sued the state yesterday for closing two DMV locations.
Yeah, so we're talking 17, 18 Democrats who have registered. Now, they got to get 2,000 signatures at least statewide, maximum 4,000. They have to file a statement of economic interest. I mean, in reality, there may be nine candidates who we're going to take seriously spring. Who knows who I'm going to make the ballot? And then of those eight or nine, there's really probably a top tier of four or five maybe. And we'll know more in about a week and a half. We get these finance reports from the second half of 2017. That'll tell us who's raising money, who put personal money in, if any, and who's not. And if you're not raising money, I mean, I know people hate money in politics, but it's a reality of life. If you don't have money, you can't spread the message. You can do doors all you want. You can't cover 3.2 million voters in Wisconsin on doors. You have to have money to spread the message.
Okay, let's spend about 2 seconds on the U.S. House. The most competitive race, as it sounds now, could be in the first, with if Mr. Bryce can get some more traction versus Mr. Ryan,
Dems,
assuming Mr. Ryan runs again, the political story.
Dems are trying to play up their chances against Grothman, Glenn Grothman.
That's true. Cole
so,
versus...
That would be interesting. Republicans talk about Ron Klein as a target, but I get the impression, you see some national stories once in a while about how Klein has a Trump seat because Trump won the third district in 2016. But I get the impression, the third, that the chance to go after Ron Klein really was in 2016 because nobody saw that wave coming. Klein was unopposed. He banked, he's got like $3 million in the bank, something like that. So now you have Ron Klein's attention. There's a Republican announced against him already, but Ron Klein is not going to be caught off guard in this environment. So I'm not sure how committed that would be. So Cole maybe against Grothman. The first is going to attention because I don't know for sure if Randy Bryce in the end will be a real threat to Paul Ryan if Paul Ryan runs. I mean, we saw the stories in December about he may walk away, but Bryce has been proven to be a great fundraiser. He raised $1.5 million almost in like 4 months. He's got a fourth quarter number coming up before too long. That's real money. But Paul Ryan's got real, real money. He had $10.4 million in the bank at the end of September. So we'll see. It's a Republican-leaning seat, a good Republican-leaning seat. I'm talking like low 50s to mid-50s, and it can get higher than that in different environments.
Yeah, and just a P.S., I just got done taping a Newsmakers interview with Congressman Mark Buchan, who's healthy again. He predicts Paul Ryan runs. Now let's look at the timetable here. So you file on June 1. You have 6 weeks to win a primary, because our primary partisan primary elections are August 14th, and then, of course, the November election on November 6th. So you only have a six-week window to win this, especially when you're talking about 8, 10, 12 Democratic candidates for governor.
Yeah, so things I'm watching are, one, who emerges from the first round reports as a real candidate.
You're going to watch those campaign finance statements, are you?
Come July, the second round, who kind of reinforces that? Then we might see some debates at some point. You know, how do you debate with who are you going to include? Mm-hmm. That's going to be a real challenge for media outlets and others, is who are you going to include in these debates? If you're going to put one on statewide TV, do you limit it to 6 or 8? I mean, we saw what happened with Republican debates on the presidential side in 15 with more than a dozen candidates. They kind of become the circus of people trying to compete for time, right? So that's something to watch. How much money Walker raises, I'm going to bet you money that he will, if he has a good number, he'll put it out before they're due January 15th, because they want to play it up that he's in a strong position financially. Does outside money come in? What's the environment like? I mean, there's all kinds of things to watch between now and November 6th.
Yeah. Okay. News also this week, two members of the legislature have joined the Governor Walker administration. Mm-hmm. Representative Keith Ripp is no longer a representative. He is a Deputy Assistant Secretary of the State Department of Ag, Trade, and Consumer Protection. Former State Senator Frank Lissay, because he also resigned, mm-hmm. $101,000 a year administrator for the Department of Workforce Development.
Ripp about 105,
and they Mr. Ripp at 105.
A little less than $51,000 a year as lawmakers.
I think they make $50,900 now.
Yeah.
Mr. Lissay, we've known, had been looking for other opportunities for a long time.
Yeah. And so for Republicans, I mean, in holding these seats come fall, the first is a seat Republicans should hold. Like in a normal environment, it is a Republican seat. Now with Lissay, he ran for for Congress in the 8th Congressional District last year.
Yep,
primary wasn't that kind to him. There were questions about his residency, which had popped up before. Does he live in De Pere and Racine, that kind of stuff. There could have been some baggage for him. But Republicans weren't counting on him running anyway. They knew he was looking for a job, so they weren't really counting on him. Andre Jacques already announced for that seat. State rep from De Pere, Republican. I'm told others will run or look at it at least. So the question becomes, is it easier to hold that seat with an incumbent, because incumbents usually have, you know, powers of incumbency and advantages, mm-hmm. or a fresh face in the environment we're looking at? It's one thing to watch up there. The Ripp seat, it's a little more swingy than Lissay's seat.
That's more in play.
It's kind of more of a 52-ish Democratic seat. Now, Trump did well there, 54%, I want to say, in November of 16. Ripp, though, would often outperform the top of the ticket. So he was at 58% versus Trump at 54.
Right.
So Republicans will be hard-pressed to find somebody Ripp's quality for that seat. And Democrats have targeted it for, I don't know how many cycles have they told me that's going to be the seat will be in play. And Ripp keeps winning easily, you know.
Yeah, so he kept winning easily. He's a farmer. He has a trucking operation. Mm-hmm. And now he's an assistant secretary of the Department of Agriculture. So that's pretty close to what he's been focusing on in his career in the assembly.
And for Democrats, the challenge is it can't just be a wave that you rely on. You have to have quality candidates who raise good money, have real messages, and have a positive message to sell to voters. You know, we've seen wave elections where somebody, I don't say it was a mistake, but rode the wave on accident almost, right?
Yes.
Wasn't prepared, wasn't expecting it. But in seats like Ripp's, where there is a Republican lean to it, you can't just say, okay, it's going to be a Dem year. Let's ride that wave. You've got to have some coming quality there. Now, in pure swing seats, you know, maybe surprise seats maybe, but that one, you know, they're going to have their eye on that. I guess I'm saying Republicans will have their eye on that seat and aren't going to like take it for granted come November.
Well, and while we're looking at potential candidates, I was surprised that Johnny Kermanos of the Department of Justice is looking at Coinga's seat, assembly seat.
Yeah, he told me that. I've heard that rumoring for a while. He told me that he is from the district. He was born in the district or up there. He went to school at UW, has moved back and lived there. So he's keeping an eye on it. He says Brad Schimmel knows he's looking at it as well.
Yeah, interesting. Okay, we got about 3 minutes. Your stock report, rising.
Adam Jarko, so we talked a little bit of the dynamic there before about that 10th Senate district. I'm not predicting he's going to win, but that you can't ignore the flurry of ads on his behalf. I mean, that is clearly an advantage to have that going on for him. Now, again, for Democrats, they're counting on a motivated base, targeted, you know, calls, digital ads maybe, stuff to get them to turn out. It'll be interesting to watch how that plays out and if there is really a Dem wave coming.
Oh, in the 10th, how long has it been since a Republican has held that seat?
Alice Clausing lost that seat in 2000, my first election I covered in Wisconsin.
2000. Okay. Mixed.
GOP unity. So this week there was this unity pledge that the GOP issued to Senate candidates. And the easy story of that was, oh, look, they signed a pledge, and a couple hours later they were bickering again. I'm talking about Kevin Nicholson and Leah Vukmir, who went at it over the Steve Bannon endorsement, or his PACs, Bannon-Link PAC endorsing Nicholson. The nuance that wasn't really picked up in some of these stories was that the party wasn't trying to police behavior between now and August. The party wanted to make sure that these two guys, whoever wins, and don't forget Eric Hovde, he might get in as well, whoever wins that race, the losers or loser will endorse that person and be unified post-August. The second thing is they don't want anybody to blow up the endorsement process at convention. What that refers to is come May, there'll be in Milwaukee, there'll be a vote of the delegates. If any candidate gets 60% of the vote of the delegates on the floor, that candidate will get the party's endorsement. That means access to party infrastructure, access to party donor lists. The party has used the August primary as a kind of trial run for turn-on operation. They'll make phone calls and say, hey, don't forget to vote, you know, in the August primary. Oh, by the way, we endorsed Leah Vukmir or Kevin Nicholson or Eric Hovde, okay? That helps. They don't want to see a repeat of like 2010, when Mark Newman, who was running for governor, realized that Scott Walker had the inside track for the endorsement, called Newman and said, I want my name pulled off the endorsement ballot. The party said no. 2012, Mark Newman was running for U.S. Senate, and went to that convention, and behind the scenes was like challenging credentials of delegates and trying to cause problems and really, you know, pushing the process, trying to massage who was going to vote to help him out. Party officials want to avoid that scenario. By the way, a consultant who worked for Newman in 10 and 12 was working for Kevin Nicholson. He's not there anymore. Now he's in the super PAC. But they want to avoid that scenario of somebody trying to blow up the process and then causing a problem at convention in May.
Okay, but now that Steve Bannon is so radioactive, is Nicholson going to have to put distance between he and Mr. Bannon?
He didn't immediately. You know, his campaign turned around, said, well, Leah was trying to get this guy's endorsement as well. She's just upset that it... So I don't know. It's hard to know if the average voter cares about that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Now, we'll talk about it.
Yeah, we
love
it.
People on social media will talk about it, but I don't think the average voter is in tune to that. But, you know, that endorsement vote, that could be really big to watch. And don't forget, Nicholson's now getting another $1 million from John Bolton's super PAC in air. I tallied $2.3 million in ads between October 1st and mid-November, or the FEC, praising Kevin Nicholson. Bolton's PAC is doing... It says a million. It's a fraction at the start. They're going to roll it out more. That's starting to build his name. I mean, that's good stuff for Nicholson to have that on the air when Leah Vukmir, who we all think has this, you know, built-in advantage of the base, there's been no spending on her behalf on paid media so far.
Go back to what you just said. She apparently has a built-in advantage with the base, something we'll see. We'll see if that's true.
Mm-hmm.
And falling.
Paul Nehlen,
Republican challenger to Mr. Ryan?
Maybe last time we talked about this guy. Look, he has zero credibility in Wisconsin. He has zero chance of beating Paul Ryan. Now one of his last, like, legs to stand on was Steve Bannon, and Breitbart says this guy's dead to us because he had these incendiary tweets. He went on a white nationalist podcast or something like that. As somebody said, if Steve Bannon, the alt-right is saying, so-called alt-right is saying, you're dead to us, what's that say about you? This guy has just kind of become this show where he's got people giving him money because they think that Paul Ryan's not conservative enough or whatever. As long as he'll get that money, it's a money machine. It's an operation. It's a business for him. He's making money off of this. Otherwise, this guy has zero credibility in Wisconsin and no chance come
That's
November.
That's a good call.
August.
Lots to follow in 2018. Yeah. I'm Steve Walters.
And I'm J.R. Ross.
That's Rewind for January 5, 2018.
Rewind, your week in review, is sponsored by the Transportation Development Association of Wisconsin. Sharing one goal, enhancing the quality of life in Wisconsin through the development and maintenance of a strong transportation network. The Transportation Development Association of Wisconsin. It's how we get there.